Hello, everybody. Welcome along. Aaron Noonan here with the V8 Sleuth podcast. Great to have you with us. The guest this week is Lee Holdsworth, and we've split this chat into two parts across 2 weeks. Plenty to cover in part one. Before we get into that, just quickly, our Bathurst Going Global podcast promo's been going great guns. Your chance to knock $10 off our Bathurst 12-hour GT book. Go to the bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au website, use the code PEPPER, and you'll get $10 off when you go through the checkout. That offer is not valid with any other offer, and it ends on Feb 28. Now, Lee Holdsworth, plenty to talk about in this first part of the pod. We talk about the recent news that he's no longer a full-time supercars driver, his TCR gig driving an Alfa Romeo, and the backing that's come from his former Erebus team boss, Betty Klemenko. We go back to where his love for motorsport all started, and how a bit of advice, actually, from a Ford legend pointed him, of all things, to the Commodore Cup. We talk about his debut in the Bathurst 1000, which came with just 8 practice laps in a V8 supercar around the mountain under his belt, joining Gary Rogers Motorsport for that wonderful chapter of his career, and the origins of the lethal nickname. So here we go. Buckle up. Time to start. Part one of Lee Holdsworth on the V8 Sleuth podcast. Well, he has been in the headlines to start this season. We haven't even turned a wheel yet as we record this. Lee Holdsworth, welcome to Sleuth HQ. We've bought you a coffee. We've got you sat down. You're comfortable. You're relaxed. This could go anywhere from here, my friend.
Yeah, you're trying to loosen me up with a coffee here, mate. No, thanks for having me on. It's always enjoyable to catch up with you, Noons.
I tell you, it's been a little while. Last year in that same chair, at the very start of the year, a bloke called Caruso sat there. And he couldn't remember a thing about his career. It's like the chair just drained all of his memory from his career. So I hope it doesn't happen to you, because these podcasts are built on the history of your career. So
I noticed that the chair height was boosted up a little bit, so it's perfect.
There's a few short jokes coming. Don't worry about that. Let's cover off the now. Obviously, the news came out recently that you are no longer a full-time supercars driver. It's taken us a while to get our head around that. How did you go getting your head around that concept? Because it comes for everybody at some point, but it probably came a bit quicker than you would have otherwise hoped and expected.
Yeah, I mean, when you're in a contract, you sort of feel that you never expect that it's going to end short of the end of that contract. So towards the end of last year, you know, there are a few things happening with sponsor movements, and then obviously the license situation at Tickford. They had 4 licenses and sold, sorry, 3 licenses with a customer, and the customer license was sold. So then they had 4 drivers for 3 cars. So it never really concerned me too much until probably a couple of weeks after Bathurst, and that's when, you know, there were rumours happening and that sort of thing, and I had to knuckle down and get to the bottom of it. And sure enough, there was no position for me, which is, a real shame, because I was really enjoying myself there, and I really felt like we made a really good gain at Bathurst with the car, and 2021 was going to be a stronger year again. But hey, it is what it is, and I'm moving on.
So you had no clue. You went to Bathurst, the last race of the championship, thinking that nothing was untoward for the following year. So you've kind of joined this list of guys who did their final full-time round but didn't know it at the time.
Yeah, it's funny how it worked out. I mean, when you've been in the sport for so long, you know, 15 years, and I think it was 17 years since I started my first race in supercars, not to mention the couple of years in development series before that, you hope to end your career knowing that it's the end. And it was just a shame to finish up at Bathurst and then look back and go, hey, that was actually my last race. At this point anyway, you know,
let's call it the Will Davison effect, because you can go out and you can come back in, and you can come back into a very good car.
Yeah. And I think with Gen 3, you know, it reduces costs. So it gives the teams probably a bit more ability to hire guys like myself that, you know, can't bring a bundle of money. So I'll leave that door open. But, I mean, looking back at Bathurst, it wasn't a bad way to finish if that was my last full-time round. It wasn't a bad way. I've got some good memories of that round. And, you know, to be provisional pole was just brilliant, a real, exciting moment in my career. And we didn't quite have the car for the race, but, shared the car with Caruso, good mate. So it was a pretty cool way to go out. but yeah, just would have been nice
to know that you were going out.
At least I'll be back at Bathurst anyway for hopefully a few years yet.
Now, as we record this, your enduro deal for Bathurst isn't revealed. I'm not even going to ask you because I know you're not going to tell me, but when people listen to this down the track, it's probably been announced and unveiled, and they can go, oh, he knew at the time when we were listening to that and recording that, but he didn't tell
us. No, you already. You know everything, mate.
I'm not even going to try. Not going to try. But what you are doing this year, TCR, Alfa Romeo with Ash Seward, one of the things that caught my eye when I saw the photos of you having a bit of a burn down at Soggy Simmons Plains recently, Erebus is on the bonnet. Erebus Garage. Tell me about this. So is this the workshop business that they've got within the race team that services road cars? Give me the take, because it's taking me back to the files here, because you're a former Erebus driver. So how does Erebus end up on an Alfa?
Betty Clemenko, once she saw the rumours about me not having a drive, she rang me and said she'd love to help out and with my next step, which is just bloody brilliant, really. I mean, from where I was, at that point I was like, shit, what do I do now? Like,
and this is what, November last year?
It was probably more so, geez, it was just before the new year. So it was very late in the piece. And I had Ash give me a call, and I was speaking to a few other teams about coming and driving with TCR, because it's a sort of natural path to go, I think, after supercars or even, you know, before supercars. So there was a drive lined up for me, but obviously, you know, everyone needs a bit of a budget behind them to get the car to the track. And at that point, I didn't have much behind me at all. So Betty really got the ball rolling for me. So
it's all her fault, really.
It's her fault. but yeah, I'm just massively in debt to her personally. So you know, just she's been amazing, and we've always had a great relationship since the Erebus days. I'm pretty stoked to have her support.
Now, speaking of your racing chapter, I want to rewind it way back. You talk about the afterlife of supercars. Let's talk about the pre-racing life of supercars. And there's a lot to cover, but where's the racing bug bite Lee Holdsworth? Was your brother Brett already racing? Was your dad racing karts? How did it get to you? Because I've got a feeling that you kind of started it more than anyone in the family.
It started with Dad. He just loves motorsport, always has. If there's any motorsport on telly, he was watching it. So, he started off when he was young. He was a tow truck driver, so a pickup driver when he at the race meetings. So he was going and picking up, you know, Moffat's car and bloody Brockies and all sorts of stuff. So that's where he got his love affair with racing.
And where was this? Was this in Queensland?
Out of Calder, yeah, down in Victoria. Down. So I was born here and down in Melbourne and moved up to Queensland. So I grew up from 7 years up to 21 years old. I was in Brisbane and then came back down here. So, most of my family are from Melbourne. And mum and dad are still up there in Queensland, as well as my brother Brett. But we got into it, as you do. You know, when your dad's watching something on telly, you sort of sit down with him and spend some time, and you develop your interest through that as well. Yep. So when we're about, I think probably about 4 years old, my brother's only 18 months older, so 4 and 5 years old.
He's 18 months older, but he's about a foot taller. How does that work out?
Yeah, I don't know. there's questions about where he came from, to be honest. So we were 4 and 6 or something around there, and we got we were wanting motorbikes. Brett and I, we just loved motorbikes.
Dangerous.
We used to put the bottle in the back wheel, you know, the plastic bottle, yeah, so our road bikes would sound like. Anyway, so, and Dad hates motorbikes. So
you were no chance to get
no
a motorbike
chance,
there.
No right. chance. And he must have told Santa, because Santa just delivered us a go-kart 1 year.
And were you disappointed?
For Christmas.
This is crap, I didn't ask for this?
No, I think we had 2 wheels each out of the go-karts. It was like a motorbike each. But it was sitting in our room one morning when we woke up, and it was honestly, to this day, probably the best day of my life. So we got to share that go-kart for, I was 6 years old, and by that stage we moved to Queensland when I was six anyway. So I started, you couldn't get your license till you were seven. Started practicing when I was six. and I couldn't reach the pedals.
Nothing's changed.
Nothing's changed. So we put training wheels over the pedals for me to reach the throttle and the brake. And obviously we had to slip them off for Brett when he raced, but it was just so cool. And you know, once you got the bug, it doesn't go away.
Yeah, once it's in. Now, we talked just before about the aftermath of, and you said about TCR could be a run-up to supercars for other drivers. Your career pathway to supercars is completely unique. No one's done what you've done. No one did the Commodore Cup pathway through. And a lot of our listeners might go, Commodore Cup, what's that? Because it's not around anymore. But in the mid-90s, they created this category called Commodore Cup with VB, VC, VH Commodores, the 4.2-litre V8. Later on, they got the newer bodies and stuff like that. But it was they put them on a Hoosier tyre. I think Dale Wood's dad raced it for a time. There was a bunch of guys in Victoria that got it up and running. And then it kind of spread in the late 90s and the early noughties as a cost-effective circuit racing V8 category. And you're the only guy. I mean, other guys have done a bit of V8s, but not to the level that you have from that series. Was that a case of the bang for buck to go that way? Because, I mean, you did a bit of open wheeler stuff later, but was that the case of I want to go supercars and this is where we're going to start because this is what matches our wallet?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, through go-karts, we were only, you know, state-level races. We didn't go, well, I did one national, but, you know, that was a huge deal to us. We didn't have any new tyres or anything. So we were always budget races. Brett and I shared a go-kart most of the time, and then I think for the last few years of our career in go-karts, we had our own second handies.
Look out.
So most of the time they had cracks in the chassis and all sorts of stuff, but it taught us how to get the most out of our equipment. So then Brett moved into Commodore Cup. I was 16 or 17. He moved into Commodore Cup. We bought one off Tim Shaw down in Tassie.
Who was a bit of a gun.
He was a gun in that series. Yeah. I think he won a few championships, and then he was up against DeGoston and Emery and a few of those guys, Greg Waters. They were the guns back then, and Brett entered that category and did a really good job. Like, I think he was I think he ran top five or top three in his first year. And then I had to, you know, naturally had to go somewhere after go-karts. So when I was 17, that was my last year at go-karts. And I think that year I raced my first Commodore Cup race as well. So we just leased out a car for the weekend. Then the following year, yeah, it was such a cheap form of motorsport. I mean, I would have loved to, if we had the money or the backing, I would have gone to Formula Ford, but we didn't. And I think, you know, my dad used to have these meetings for his company where he'd have a Christmas breakfast and they'd invite a guest speaker. And it was actually Dick Johnson came along and we had a good chat to him. And he said to us, he said, where are you trying to head with this? And I said, supercars. It's always been where I've wanted to go. And he said, well, don't go Formula Ford, go Tin Top. And we said, well,
this
how about
is before the days of the Super 3 series. You know, Super 2 didn't turn up till 2000. It was probably not quite on the radar there, but there wasn't those other platform steps there.
That's right, anyway. Yeah. So Commodore Cup was the way to go. So we went racing. I think we were spending about $30,000 a year each on a Commodore Cup car, and we both ran at the front, and I did that for 2 years, and I was best rookie the first year, fifth in the championship, and then the second year I was third in the championship. And then got to a point where Brett and I, we really didn't have, or more so my family, mum and dad, they didn't have the money to see us both go
further. So they
further.
Purely backed you both all the way through. TTM was it was traffic management.
TTM, traffic management. They're now in the hands of someone else now. Dad sold them a long time ago, and now Brett's got his company of TPS and Pry Park, which was a side business of TTM that was, you know, separate after all that to TTM. So,
but there's no one else helping on the backing front. Maybe a couple of little bits
just
to client, help,
just
but it
a few of Dad's clients. But it was a lot of it was out of our pocket. I was throughout go karts. I was cleaning the office. That was
the janitor.
I think I was $300 a month, and that'd get us an engine refresh once a year in our go kart. So I was always trying to chip in, and then I became the filing clerk. And
how was your filing, by the way? Were you any good?
out of sight, out of mind for me, you know.
Stick it in the filing cabinet and shove it in there. You'd be great for spring cleaning. Just put it in the cupboard.
That was someone else's problem in a few days. I did as much as I could to help, and then I started working at the driving centre as well out at Norwell to earn a bit of cash as well. But, yeah, so Brett and I, we were always on a shoestring budget, but we got to that point after 2 years of Commodore Cup. Brett was very, very entrenched in the business side, the family business, and I wasn't interested. I only had one thing in mind, and that was to go racing. So I was out chasing sponsors every day. It was a decision that, we had to come to as a family as to what we were going to do then, because, you know, going into, at the time it was Development Series, was the next step. There was no step in between, and that was, you know, a fair bit more money. And so Brett had to step out of racing, which, you know, I still really, you know, I owe him a lot for. But I was always the committed, you know, I was fully committed. He was out, you know, at a go-kart meeting, he'd be going to a party the night before, whereas I was in bed and I'd wake up in my race suit ready to go. we had different sort of plans, and although he had as good ability, he just didn't have the same commitment. So yeah, into Smith's Trucks we went.
I was going to say, was that the first V8 you drove, the Smith's Trucks Commodore? Did you drive something else before that?
No, that was the first supercar I ever drove.
And how did that link? Because Robert Smith is from Ballarat, my hometown, trucking business owner who had bought a couple of different ex-supercars and touring cars up to that point, had a run himself as well. How did the link? I think he, by that stage, had kind of stepped out of driving and was putting some young guys in the cars in previous opportunity. Owen Kelly had a run the previous year.
James Small. Yeah, he was there the day I tested.
Right. With
them. Yeah, so it was him and I out there the same day.
So we're at what, 2004 is when you started in DBS. So is this 2003?
That was in probably the end of 2003. I think I would have jumped in that car.
Yeah.
And I forgot, I tested a Formula Holden just before that, out at Wakefield Park with Graham Watson's Rolt.
Ah, the late Graham Watson, the Rolt team.
Rolt. And that was honestly the most awesome thing ever, but that was going to cost us more. So we and to be honest, I'm glad I did. You know, I'm glad we did go the way we did, because I think, you know, sticking to the tin top path was a good thing to do. And, so I was helping out. Whilst I was in Commodore Cup, the for those 2 years, I was helping.
So that's 2002-03, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, because 2004 was your first year in DBS.
Yep, that's right. Yep. Thanks for reminding me.
You're doing better than Caruso so far. He couldn't remember where he'd been or what he'd done.
So I emailed all these team managers in supercars and I said, hey, just want to help out, sweep the floors, do tire pressures, whatever you want me to do, wipe the car over. I just want to be there. I just want to get amongst it and see what happens in the pits. And so, I remember Ryan McLeod was the guy that got back to me.
Who was working with Robert Smith.
Yep. Yeah. I think it was Imrie Motorsports at the time, IMS.
Yeah, because Mike had run his team and then kind of, I think, that sort of rolled through some of the personnel, then got involved with running Robert's
cars.
That's
right, So I went to Bathurst and helped out, it was DeGoston and Daryl Beattie in the car.
That's right. So that's 2002.
Yeah.
They ran two cars.
Yep. That's right, yeah. So they had...
So you were what were you doing there? Just anything?
I was tyre pressures.
You're the king of pressure.
King of pressure, yeah.
Yeah, nice.
I love a bit of pressure. But it was the funniest meeting. I was so stressed because I was on tyres. And, you know, it's a big job.
It's important. Like, you get it wrong, it's bad.
Yeah. I'm surprised now. Looking back, I'm going, geez, that was a big call to put me on tyre pressures my first round. But I did it.
Did you know how to run a pyrometer?
I didn't have the fire. That was not my job. That was
That's right. You were just a pressure man. You didn't do that. Okay.
So it was a really funny one. I had Mike Imrie telling me what tire pressures to put in. So he'd say, put in 28 and 30 or whatever. So I'd do that. And then I'd have Ryan McLeod come over and he'd say, I want 26 and 27. And I say, but Mike Emery just told me, you know, blah, blah, blah. No, what? No, don't listen to him. I'm the bloody team manager here.
But he's the team owner.
So I'd do it, and then Mike would come back, and he'd go, are those tie presses at this and this? And I'd say, no, yeah. Ryan just told me. So it was a bit of a shit fight, and I caused a bit of a stir between the two of them because they both disagreed. But anyway, I chose Ryan's side on that, and Ryan actually. So from that point on, those guys were watching my career in Commodore Cup, and then Robert Smith got involved with that team, and he got his development series team going. I forget who was running in the year before I was there, but
I think they're doing a bit of a standalone type thing, and Ryan had been helping him out. Yeah. Owen Kelly drove in 03.
Yes, Owen Kelly.
Them.
Yeah,
in an ex Gibson car.
That's right. Yeah. So I went to they asked me to a test day, and we had James Small there as well out at Winton and did a few laps.
Who
there
at the time was Formula Fording?
Yeah.
Who now is a crew chief in NASCAR. He was your engineer at GRM some years later. Crazy. I remember that you snuck around the rule there for Friday practice and test days because you could stick your engineer in because he was a driver as well.
Yeah, and he was a gun.
He had a rookie day or two, didn't he?
Yeah.
No other engineer got let loose. Later
in the show, I'm sure we can talk about how Gary once offered him an endurance drive to stay in the team. But yeah, anyway, we'll get to that. But yeah, so it was a funny one. But yeah, so those guys really helped me out, and I got that drive. We had to come up with a bit of money. Smithy was brilliant in funding most of it. So
he said, just find a bit.
Yeah,
top it up.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, he had his Smith's trucks down the side, which paid for most of it, it just landed in my lap, really. Like, I went searching for it, but the opportunity came and I took it and had some good guys in the team.
One of the themes that we've really covered in this podcast over 2.5 years with our sit-down chats is that for everyone and anyone who makes it anywhere in the sport, somewhere along the line there's maybe 2, 3, 4, 1, 5 people that made the difference. You met them at the right time. They opened a door. They gave you an opportunity. They stuck 10 grand in here. They did something, and including Robert Smith's, beyond, of course, your mum and dad and your family, but then kind of in the, if you did the next 2 or 3 people who, if you didn't meet them or if you didn't do that thing, it wouldn't have got you to the next thing. Yeah. He was kind of the, if there's no Robert Smith at that point, maybe no one else is in that position to give you a hand, and you don't get in the door and you're not here now.
Yeah, well, it's exactly right. I mean, every step in your career, there's always that someone, you know, it's one of the, you know, we all know motorsport is such a small community that you can't burn bridges. You've got to
you might have to cross the track
over that. and often you do, you know, it comes around in circles. So, I felt like I'd put in a big effort with people and I'd get back from someone and that's the opportunity I'd take. So, Robert Smith came forward, Ryan McLeod, huge parts of my career. And then after a couple of years, I did most of the season with Robert Smith, in 2004 in development series. I think I did 3/4 of the season. And then the following year, I did much the same, but I didn't have a budget for that second year. So, again, Smithy came forward and helped me out. And then at the end of that year, I'd been approaching everyone, obviously, for a co-drive, because now was the time to get yourself in there.
Yeah.
And I went to Queensland Raceway and no one really wanted to speak to me. But Gary Rogers said, hey, let's meet in the truck. He'd actually, before the meeting, I'd never heard from him. And I went and I think Will Davison was racing in the DJR car in development series that weekend as
2005,
well.
He did a one-off. 2005,
yeah. So we get out there and I put it on second on the grid. And
I remember that. Yeah, in the Smith's car.
Yeah, and I think
in the DVS race.
Davo might have been third and Canto pole or something. It was something like that. Anyway, yeah. So then I get a call from Gary and I say, come and meet me in the truck. And that's how the co-drive came about. So I then teamed up with Philip Skyfleet that year.
But you'd already teamed up with him before.
I had actually, yeah.
So we should rewind a little bit. So in 2004 you did the DVS in a Smith's Trucks car.
Yeah.
There were two cars. A lot of people might remember.
Alan Gurr
drove the other one, won the first round at Wakefield Park in the wet.
In the wet.
So it's your first year, driving a supercar. Mm. But for the end of that year, it was sort of a different time then in the championships, because you could take your development series car and you could, through not really wild cards like we have now, but you had the opportunity to run at the Enduros and some of the bigger events under other licenses and things. Mm-hmm. So the opportunity arose that they put yourself with Phil for the Sandown 500.
Yeah.
And do you remember how that went?
I do.
It didn't go very good, did it?
I think I don't think I jumped in the car for the race.
I think it caught fire.
Yeah, I think we had an airbox fire, and Phil ended up parking in just down a second last corner in the sand trap, trying to get to the fire marshals.
Had to bail. Yeah.
And it was a pretty good burn too.
Bad burn. No. It's a bad burn. Not a good burn when it's burning.
No.
Because then for Bathurst, you were with Mark Noski.
Yes.
In the Smith's Trucks car. So that's tell me about your first Bathurst in the supercar and all the stories and bits and pieces.
What an experience. So I'd done a very few laps in practice.
So had you ever been
there? I'd never, ever been around
Not
Bathurst.
In anything? Because Commodore Cup didn't race there back in the day, did they?
Like, there's no way these days that allow anyone to do
no
it.
No way.
So I jumped on track in practice. So I probably did 8 flyers and 8 lap times. I got down to, back then, a good time would have been a 9. And I think I got down to a 12 after 8 laps, and I was hanging on. I was really hanging on. And I came in, and they said, all right, mate, now Mark's going to qualify, blah, blah, blah. So
that stage, he'd done a lot of Bathurst.
Done a lot,
so he's pretty experienced.
Done a lot. So it was pretty cool at the time to team up with Mark Noski. You know, he was a
And do you remember
that? Name.
He'd been around a long time, but your first Bathurst was Brock's last.
Ah, it was.
Because he's driving for HRT.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. But didn't he race a Team Brock car?
2 years before that.
Ah.
Yeah, 04 was his last one in an HRT
that's
car.
Right. Well,
he didn't get to drive it.
Yeah.
He it was like you at Sandown.
Yeah.
He didn't get to have a drive.
Yeah.
Plato had the shunt prior to that with John Clellan. So.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, he missed out.
Yep. I remember Mum freaking out about that BOC car rolling
on its
coming
roof.
Out of the chase. Yeah. Yep. So, anyways, we get to the race.
And by this stage, how many laps have you done?
Probably not another two laps, maybe. I don't think I even did that. I think I'd done 8 laps all up, 6 laps, 8
laps. So you've
laps.
Done a grand total of about 50 kilometres of competitive racing speed driving at Bathurst before being let loose in the Bathurst 1000.
Yeah, yeah. So, and to make matters worse, mate, listen to this.
Yeah. Oh, here we go.
Listen to this.
Now we're getting the good stuff.
So, Mark starts. He got a penalty for passing before there was a safety car, and he passed someone before the line on the restart. So he got a penalty. He comes into pit lane. We drive a change. I go.
You can't do a driver change for a penalty.
Sorry.
Is it a drive-through?
Sorry. He'd served his penalty.
Right.
We went down a lap.
Yep.
Comes in, puts me in the car for my first lap ever around in the Bathurst 1000. And there's a safety car. And I'm at the front of the field. Like, first car behind the safety car.
Are you about to
go
a lap down or a lap down about to go two down?
No, sorry. I was just about to go a lap down.
Right.
So Ryan's saying to me over the radio, Ryan McLeod, he said, mate, don't let him pass over the top. Just let him pass down the bottom. And I went up. It was about my second lap in. I think a few cars had gone past. And I'd done my fastest lap, just trying to hang with the pack. And I came around for the next lap, and I had, I think it was Greg Murphy, Ambrose, and Ingle up my ass, pushing me.
A bunch of no ones.
Pushing me up over the top. And I come down, I'm hard up against the wall on every corner, thinking that, you know, this must be how those guys feel, like freaking out. And I get down to the bottom of the dipper, come out, and I see Thomas Mazura going quite slow, coming down the hill in the track car.
In the toll car, yeah.
We get to Forest Elbow, and he goes super slow on the inside, and I'm thinking, he's letting me through here. So I went around the outside, and then he started rolling through the corner, and I'm on the high line, the dirty line, and obviously smacked the fence on the exit. So I've taken out the front right corner, There was a slight sigh of relief, but
the pressure went away. Yeah. But also, your right front did as well.
Yeah, it was a sad way to end your first Bathurst 1000, but it ends like that for a lot of drivers. But yeah, that was an experience for me, and it was a real eye opener. I'm like, these guys play for keeps, and Bathurst is a scary place.
Mm, yeah, if you haven't bitten the concrete there before, you're gonna. It's not a case of if, but when. I think from memory too, did you not run another? You did a solo round at the end of that year.
A solo round at Eastern Creek.
Yeah, there you go. So that was your first
with
solo
with Les Small
go.
On the radio.
Oh, that's an experience.
So James's dad. That was an experience. I think I'd ripped my headphones out at one point. But, that was in the Smith's Trucks car again, last round of the year. So that was a great experience.
So you got a gauge then.
A really good gauge.
Right on now, I know where I got to get to be hanging out with these boys.
Yeah, that's right. That was the last round of 2004.
Mm-hmm.
So then... Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so, and I think I finished 22nd or something. And I look back at those names behind me, and I had some guys that had good credentials.
And when the field was about 35, not 25.
Yeah.
So when you're 22nd, it doesn't sound as flash if you're applying today's field to it.
Yeah.
But to that field of that era, you've got a few behind you. You're two thirds of the field, not.
That's right. And it was I think they purposely did that one because it was the one where I went quite well in development series my first year. I won that reverse grid race and had really good pace. So they were like, all right, he might be good to go in the main series and see what he's got. So, and that's the thing, when you get into the main series after being in development series, it's like you think, okay, this is, before you get there, you think, yeah, I'll run competitively. I know I'm not going to win, blah, blah. But you get there and you go, holy shit, like this is intense. Mm. At that stage of your career, you're not getting anywhere near out of the car what you need to, and it shows you where you need to get to. Mm. So then your next meeting in development series or, the following year, it gave me a ballpark on how hard I needed to go to get to where – that standard and it was good to do that because the next year in development series I really took a massive leap forward and knew exactly what I needed to do to get there.
And that next year too, it was a bit of a double program because a lot of people forget that you went back and did Formula Ford.
I did.
Because that had been, and I always thought that had not been part of your intended pathway, but obviously as we've discussed, the reason why you ended up in Commodore Cup and you didn't go and do Formula Ford. Was that a case of I need to go and do that to better my skills a little bit more and sort of fill in the gap that I kind of – it was like skipping a grade somewhere back in the track. Was that the reason or tell me some more about that?
There's a different reason actually.
I feel like we're getting a scoop here.
This has probably never been said before. But so I met Alana at the end of 2003.
Now, and this was on my list too to ask you how you met your wife, by the way, but you're going to answer it without me asking.
I met her at the flirt night at Regatta Hotel up in Brizzy. Anyway.
At the what?
It was at the Regatta Hotel.
No, the other bit.
Flirt night.
What's a flirt night?
It's where you – it's pretty cheesy, but you used to go to the pub and you'd get a number. You'd have a number on you, 323 or whatever. And you'd put in – if you liked a girl or they liked you or whatever, they'd write a little message and say from – number 243 to number 311.
So this is like
and it would come up.
This is like manual Tinder.
Yeah, that was that's about as close as it got back then. And it would come up on the screen, number blah blah blah. You got a message, so you go check it, and I'd written her a message. I think I don't know. I won't. I think she's kept it, but I think she's still got the message. It's like you're the most beautiful girl in here or something. It was real, real charming. And
well, it must have been. It worked.
It worked. And anyway, so we struck up a relationship back then, and at the end of the first year, which was the end of my first year in development series, it started getting pretty serious. We wanted to move in together. Dad was pretty concerned about my commitment to racing, and with the budget that we had, it was very short. So Dad didn't want to commit to anything thinking that I wasn't fully committed. So I said to Dad, well, if you're not going to, you know, help me out here, I'm going to Melbourne.
So, was this a bit of a tiff, a bit of a blue?
A little bit, yeah, a little bit. It was
a forceful conversation.
Yeah, but I think there's a lot of the time, you know, the driver, the son needs to separate from the dad. Mm. In a lot of instances where, the dad has a lot of control, obviously,
because for they're financial reasons,
they're
money.
Very yep. invested in it. They need to split a little bit. And I thought, you know, great opportunities in Melbourne, a lot of race teams. My development series team was down there. So I said, I'm going. And the tap turned off, a little bit. So, well, a lot until Dad realized that I wasn't just there just to, you know, play around or whatever. I actually moved in with Brett and, cause he'd started a business down here and we got a little apartment in St Kilda, which was really cool, a little two bedroom. So it was Brett, Alana and I in this little apartment and a little cat that Alana begged me to get, that just died the other day after that many years.
Oh.
So there you go.
Oh, put a sour part of that right story. It's a good life though. Good cat life.
So I went and, sussed out what opportunities there are, and there was an opportunity.
There's no driving here. You don't have any.
No, I didn't have anything at this point.
But you went, I've got to get down here to be on it. Yeah.
And Smithy, you know, as much as he wanted me driving, he was saying need a bit of a budget. So I found an opportunity with Sean Scott, in a Formula Ford team, in his Formula Ford team, and they were out at Brayside. I ended up getting that drive, but I still needed to find a little bit of funding, but it was a hell of a lot cheaper than going development series racing. So once Dad realised that, you know, I was pretty passionate about it and this was not going to stop, he said, righto, you know, oh, sorry, blah, blah. Mm. I want to help you out. Let's, you know, I'll help you out with this in Formula Ford and you've got to find the rest. And, you know, so I was working full time and all that money was going back into the racing,
were you working?
Out at Brayside.
Is it Borland's?
Across the road from Borland. Yeah. Sean had his own little factory. It was myself, Jason Liefting.
Kiwi guy, yep.
Mark McNally, but they were sort of chopped and changed a few drivers at the time. And Andrew Thompson was there as well for a few races. So, yeah, I was working there pretty late every night, getting the train out there because I didn't have a car. Biking from the train station out to
Brayside for the young racing driver wannabe listeners.
Yeah,
that's commitment.
Well, I thought, you know, that showed Dad how committed I was.
You're not here for fun.
So I started that up, and then Smithy rang up. He said, "Mate, I want you to come back and do the development series with us." And I said, "I don't have anything, Smithy." And he said, "There's no dramas. Come along." So then I was racing doubling.
So you go
up
from nothing to
it was crazy. Two things, yeah. crazy.
Feast or famine.
So it was pretty. It was awesome because I learnt a lot in Formula Ford with car control. You know, Sean was quite good on the data, so I learned a lot with the data, and I could apply that to the supercar as well. I think that me driving Formula Ford helped in development series, but I'm not sure development series helped me for Formula Ford. So, anyways, it was great just to have my bum in the seat. So many appearances every year, for that year, and, it really fast-tracked my learning and prepared me better for the following year.
So you go to Queensland Raceway, you meet Gary Rogers. I presume it went well.
It went well.
Good chat.
It was a very short, short conversation, yeah, as they are with Gary. But I think, yeah, he put me into the truck and he said, righto, you keen to come race for us, the bloody, you know, at Bathurst? And I said, yeah, absolutely, Gary. He said, right, I'll see you in October. So away we went, and that was, you know, I spoke to him a few times between that time and then.
The best part, though, it wasn't how much you got.
How much?
Yeah. Most times people say you've got to drive.
Oh, yeah.
But how much you got?
I thought you meant money. No. There was certainly no money. But, yeah, it was amazing. That was huge.
When you're not
me.
Getting paid.
I'm like, this is big. You know,
you're not paying. You're not paying. When you're not getting paid, you're not paying. So it's okay.
That's right, exactly. So that was huge. And And that was really my ticket. You know, that was my ticket at that point in my career to then take the next step. And so off we went to Sandown and Bathurst that year. I forget how we went at Sandown. Maybe you could tell me.
I have to look it up, but
I think we had
teens. I think there's a few issues and dramas. I think there was a spin at some point. I remember seeing it backwards.
Yeah,
I think on the back straight. I don't know who was driving. Skyfleet
had a bit of a spin there.
Mm, yeah,
but so we went to Bathurst. I remember I came out of the pits. We were having quite a good run. I think we were in 12th or something like that, and I didn't pump the pedal coming up to turn two.
Not the first, not the last.
No. A young bloke's trap. So I came into turn two and grabbed the brake and nothing happened. So I'm pumping it up on the way in and I just got some pedal before the corner, but I was going in too quick. So I ended up ploughing into the tyre bundle, didn't get stuck, but just ploughed it and came back out the other side. And it just scuffed up all the front end. Anyway, so the next stop, I came in we did a driver change. Skyfleet jumps in and the bonnet comes up
because that's I'd ripped the pins out. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So I remember they were trying to guide him all the way back from the telly.
He's trying to drive down underneath the bonnet in the bonnet. Gap. Yeah.
Anyway,
but smashed the windscreen, didn't it?
Smashed the windscreen. Yeah. So then we had to take the rear windscreen out. I jumped back in and it was like
cold.
It was a frigging cold day. So
because more famously, Lowndes got hit in the window with a pulled umbrella tyre that day. Yeah. And his car with the Van Muller had both the windows out. So two cars in the one race with different ways of having it happen. But four drivers getting very chilly for the day. Well, it was cold that day.
It was a freezing day, but I wasn't going to complain considering I was the one that caused it. So, yeah, I pushed on and it was like a parachute down the straight and it felt like an open wheeler because my head was wobbling around.
Trying to get its way down Conrad.
and luckily I had a visor. I always wonder these guys that don't run visors, what are they going to do if they have to do that again?
But have their eyeballs blown out.
Yeah. So we finished. I came up to that.
That I know crash, where this is going.
Came up to the crash that Ambrose and Murph just had up at the cutting.
And you can hear Murph's version of that, by the way, on his episode of the podcast we did last year. We've bleeped a lot of it.
I'm sure you have. I was there to witness it.
We bleeped all of it, actually.
Yeah. And I wish I had a tape recorder because I was standing close enough to hear it. Anyway, so I've come up and I've just pulled up short of it. I'm like, beauty.
I haven't had the shunt.
Like 10 cars in front of me that are all banged
blocked.
Up.
The track's
and it's
blocked.
Completely blocked. And I thought, there's like 10 positions here. and I look up and I see Bugs comes flat out around the corner and drill the ass of my car and push me into the cars in front. So I just got completely sandwiched and it was time to jump out. So I jumped out. I got up on the inside of the track on the wall and I see Ambrose and Murph going at it. I could hear every word. It was great. Although it was disappointing, I feel like I got to witness a pretty
closest person to one of those famous moments in Bathurst history. You had it all.
So I was actually hoping I'd see a fist come out, but it was disappointing to end that race like that.
Didn't you get going though?
No, we were buggered.
They towed it.
Yeah, we were buggered.
Yeah.
So
thanks, Bugs.
Yeah, thanks, Bugs. I thought I did a really good job to pull it up.
Boom.
Anyway, so then I did my development series race there, and then we had Canto was going for the championship that year in development series.
With DJR.
And he'd already been asked to be full-time drive with Gary for the following year because I think they'd announced that Andrew Jones was leaving. Cameron McConville.
Yeah, Cameron McConville and Andrew Jones. Jonesy left after Bathurst and Canto drove Gold Coast onwards. But the final round of the DVS
was the final round
of the main game at Phillip Island.
Gary asked me to step in and that was – I'm like, I actually got an opportunity here that could put me in a seat for the following year. So
the other part of that was McConville
was leaving to PWR.
Yeah.
Um, So it was just really, I don't know whether you can say it on here, but kissed on the cock is one way I'd put it, where I had an opportunity to step into a main drive. And that weekend, I think McConville qualified 21st. I qualified 22nd or 23rd. So I wasn't too far off him. And, yeah, it was not where I wanted to qualify, but I thought, you know, he was my yardstick. And then in the race, I broke a shifter. So then I had half a
too hard on the gear.
Must be. I had half a gear stick, and the thing was digging that hard into my hand. But again, like that wasn't gonna stop me. So I ran round and round and finished up, you know, somewhere, I don't know, early 20s or high teens or something, and had a good, you know, fun weekend. But Gary always looks for someone. At the time, I didn't know this about Gary, but he always looks for someone that's going to push through, you know, and not worry about the little things like that. And I think that's probably why then I got the call up for the following year, was because he saw that, you know, this bloke's pretty keen to.
And he's got a hole in his hand as well.
Yeah.
Well, that's how keen he is.
Exactly. He saw the blister on my hand and he thought, this guy's, you know, he's not going to stop with anything. So, but it was a fairly stressful point at the end of that year, because Alana and I had just moved down to Melbourne, and it looked like it was all over again, because I'd heard rumours that Bargs was coming back and Gary wasn't showing any commitment. So I moved back. We got a little truck. We hired a little truck and drove back to Brisbane when moved in with Alana's dad. And after about 2 weeks back there, or a week back it might have been, I get a call from Gary and he said, "Can you start next week?" I said, you're bloody kidding me, Gary. Are you seriously, you've really, like,
just
you've waited
repack
for
that removal van and
I
turn it
he
around.
He knew I was going back. It's like he just wanted to see how committed I was. So anyway, I said, "Gary, I need something to show you commitment. Can you give me something?" He said, "Righto, well, I'll send you through a fax." So he sends me a fax, and it was my contract. That was my first contract, was a two-page fax from Gary. And I thought that was good enough to then, you know, get back on the road and get back to Melbourne. We then moved into a place in East Melbourne, just Alana and I. And I started work, honestly, like the day after I got back. And I was working full-time with Gary, but on a five-year deal. And that was just a dream come true.
Five-year deal for your first main game deal. There's not too many dudes to get that. That's I think we call that half a Reynolds these days. But
well, I think Gary was the Reynolds in this situation, because he could have pulled out at any point.
What was I remember when Bargs and Garth and so many of those guys got their opportunities, they had to work in the business. At the time, Gary had the car yards, and I think Garth was the man to get the spare parts down from the shelf, because he's 6'10". I think Bargs was doing spare parts, all sorts of bits and pieces. By that stage, were you race team worker, gopher? What was your actual job apart from the race driving bits on the weekends?
I really wanted to understand more about the cars. You know, Gary always wants to understand where you want to be and where your skills lie. So I just said to him, "Gary, I want to know as much about these cars as possible. I want to understand what's going wrong with the car when something goes wrong. I want to be able to give the feedback to the engineers on when there's a problem and be able to identify it so they can get onto it quicker." So I started off my first year in there as a number three on the car.
On your own car or the other car?
On my own car.
Yeah, that's a bit safer.
And really just loved that. Like, I had a great time. Adam DeBore was my engineer.
That's right, was too.
That was his first year in the category. He came over from Porsche in Europe. So, I just loved it. We'd go training at lunchtime, just Adam and I, and run over at the oval over the road. And then I'd go to, you know, other times I'd go to the swimming pool with Gypsy and eat dim sims for lunch afterwards.
By when we say Gypsy, Everyone calls him Gypsy at GRM. His name is Jeff Marshall. He's been there for bloody years in the engine shop and all sorts of stuff. He was Legend. The car controller for heaps of years at GRM. So his voice is probably familiar to people on hearing the radios on the TV broadcast back in the day.
But if you can hear the panic on the radio, go, 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 go.
Was he the bloke that used – did you skittle him one day at Bathurst? That was you?
Oh, that was Sherl. I bowled over Sherl. So
you got to have a nickname. When you're right. Now, that's an issue. Actually, that's an issue I've got to cover off. How Caruso, I think he was a little irked last year when we spoke to him. Because
he
didn't
like his nickname.
Well, I don't think he was a fan of his. But I don't think in nickname land in the universe you ever are allowed to nickname yourself.
Yeah.
But did you get away with that?
I did. You've got – when you go to GRM
– you've got to get a nickname.
You've got to tell Gary what your nickname is or he'll give you one.
So you just went off lethal. Very original, but you got off the hook of something else that could have been far worse.
Yeah, pretty much. So I got the nickname Lethal from when I was growing up. As a young bloke, I was always in hospital. Stitches in the head, you know, broken arms, broken wrists, broken legs from riding skateboards, motorbikes, anything. And you know, once I got to four wheels, I couldn't fall off as much. So that was the best place for me to be. But, yeah, so I got the nickname Lethal from a very, very young age. And then, going to Gary's, he said, what's your nickname? I said, it's Lethal. And he said, all right, that's what we're going to call you. We don't call anyone by their first names in here. And then Robbo made the terrible mistake of saying, I don't have a nickname. And he said, Robinson Caruso.
Rookie error. Yeah. Rookie error. Brought upon himself.
He did.
Well, that's part one of our chat on the V8 Sleuth podcast with Lee Holdsworth. Part two next week, we chat more about his GRM days right through to his most recent years in supercars. And we'll cover off your National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions and the Motor Focus Top 10 shootout as well. Don't forget our bookshop. It is packed with books, all sorts of stuff. bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. You can make sure that you knock $10 off the price of our Bathurst Going Global 12-hour book. It's hardcover, 320 pages, celebrating the last 10 years of the 12-hour since the GT cars have been there. And, of course, sadly, there's no 12-hour there this year. But if you've got the book, it is the thing to get you through the year without the 12-hour. That offer is not valid with any other offer, and it runs until the end of February 28. Thanks, everyone, for your podcast feedback. Tell your mates, subscribe. Keep the questions flowing. Keep the content rolling into us as well. You can sign up for our newsletter from the v8sleuth.com.au website. Follow us on all the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We're always up to something there. In the meantime, that's the V8 Sleuth podcast run and done this week. Stay tuned next week for part two with Lee Holdsworth.